I am very honored to be here, and I am honored to talk to Ron. Ron and I have met briefly years ago. We've been email pals for a while, but actually this is sort of the first substantial conversation in person we will have had. We've spoken on the phone, and so I'm honored, and I'm so glad Caleb asked me to do this tonight. Because it is no understatement to say, Ron, that you have had as much influence on me as a writer and a filmmaker than anyone outside Flannery O'Connor and William Goldman, and you know,
pretty
and
good,
so
pretty good company.
Pretty good company.
Is this on?
And yes, it is.
Okay.
And so it's a real thrill to speak to you tonight, and you guys are in the presence of greatness. I don't just mean Caleb Monroe, but I mean Ron, and it's a joy to honor you and speak to you. I first came to know Ron's work through the Image Journal in 2001 when I was a student. I encountered an essay that Ron wrote called The Spiritual Frontiers of Film, and that essay has sort of transformed me as a young writer and open my eyes to the possibilities of what film could do in the spiritual frontiers. He then later wrote a book called In a New Light, which expounded on a lot of the themes and ideas that were in that essay. And those two pieces, which I have up here with me, I carry with me, they're kind of core, I don't carry with me all the time, I'm not that obnoxious, but they are sort of core tenets for me as a writer. I was fortunate about 15 years later, a couple years ago, to guest edit an issue of the Image Journal, a film issue, in which I was fortunate enough to reprint Ron's essay from this issue and do a little intro, and he wrote a little afterword for it. I think we have some back there, actually, tonight, because I wanted to share that essay with more folks. We're going to dive into that. Now, tonight, you're going to hear a lot of artsy-fartsy terms like the unity of form and content and mimetic desire and these kind of things, but I want you to know that what's the beauty of what Ron does in his writing is a lot of it sounds so heady and theoretical on the surface, but when you dig through the topsoil into what's down there, it becomes very applicable and practical as writers. And that's what was revealed to me as I studied the work, and I've read the essay, The Spiritual Frontiers of Film essay, 100 times. I'm gonna gloat a little bit. I'm gonna like brag on you a little bit, sir, if you don't mind.
Interrupt.
Please,
of course. I just want to thank you and Caleb and anybody else that arranged this. I'm very honored to be here, and I'm very pleased. I look forward to this evening.
Yeah,
so thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you. But if you look at my essay, my original essay, so basically, like, if you go through it, it's got like it's just marked up with 47,000 markings, and it sort of speaks to how many times I've gone through this thing and just marked. There's like 7 colors of ink on this thing, and there's red, blue, pink highlighters and stuff because I go through it. And I read it often, a couple of times a year, and so I want to dive into that essay a little bit later. But what I'd like to know first is a little bit of history, and because for someone who, on paper, the journey doesn't add up, and I'm curious. I've always been curious. So Ron was a TV writer, wrote on Charlie's Angels and Mission Impossible and Canon and all these shows in the 70s, and how did that guy evolve into a man writing about deeper spiritual concerns and ideas, and how did you evolve, and where did these sort of, I know your work builds a lot on René Girard and Gil Bailey, and it builds on their, and some of their work, but how did the formation of some of your ideas about spirituality and filmmaking form?
Well, I'll have to go back a little further than the 70s. I was born and raised in Hollywood and became an actor as a teenager. So I was 50 years, really, in the business. And what led to my conversion, I will probably never know other than the grace of God, but certainly one of the things was for my generation after World War II, my religion was Hollywood. I didn't have any other tradition, and the aspirations and idealism of particularly pre-war Hollywood, films of John Ford and Frank Capra and things like that, I was a very modern young man. I didn't think I needed religion. I thought, you know, individual strength and reason and science were going to be enough.
Yeah.
But over the course of years, I realized that wasn't true. And when Hollywood failed as a religion, I was left in a vacuum, and I think a lot of people were. Mm. So it wasn't until I was 44 years old that I became a Christian, a Roman Catholic.
Oh, wow.
But I think in a way I'm representative of a lot of people of my generation who had put a lot of hope in the modern world and defined the modern world in terms of science and humanism, good things. But what was missing was God. What was missing was the sacred. And it took me a couple of decades to find that, you know. How specifically? Through people. Through people that I met. And I think all of us as Christians really need to think of ourselves as kind of a silent movie. We may speak well, we may write well, but people are going to look at us in our lives and say, maybe that man or woman knows something I'd like to know. And I met some silent movies along the way. Mm-hmm. A couple of them were Catholic priests, and so that's how I became a Catholic.
And when did you? When were you first exposed to Girard and some of the ideas that would form some of your theories on spirituality and film?
Well, I actually met René Girard, I think, in the 70s. I should also apologize. I'm 85 years old. My memory is a little shot. Sometimes I forget words. If I forget something, I'll just make up, so don't worry about it, you know. I think it was in the 70s. My friend Gil Bailey, who has written a wonderful book, this is some years ago, called Violence Unveiled. Just very briefly, René Girard is a French scholar in cultural anthropology. He's dead now. He was so important that the American Anthropology Society had a René Girard weekend. That's when I met him in Berkeley.
Okay.
But I think I met him through Gil Bailey, who was my friend. And we were just running in the same Catholic circles at this time. The key teaching, which I put in everything I've read, incidentally, I don't have any original ideas. I just take notes, you know. And the notes I took on René Girard, I think, go right to the heart, not only of what we're trying to do as writers and filmmakers, but as Christians, as human beings. And that's, we don't blame other people for our sins. We're not looking for scapegoats. And that's what the media does. Let's face it, that's what Hollywood does. Even good films usually have someone you can blame, some group or some individual. Girard exposes that not as a weakness, but as it is a weakness, but not as, it's part of the human condition. And our challenge as Christian writers is to overcome that. And we can only do that through the grace of God. So that's why we're Christians. So Girard was very important, but rather late in the date for me. Yeah.
All right, so what I want to do, I'd like to do, if it's okay with you. So I want to read a couple of passages from some of your work, and I want to, two things. I would like to unpack those a little bit for people, because there are some of the core ideas in your work, and these two pieces of work. And then also respond. I want you to respond to these ideas 20 years after you wrote them in some cases. So I'm curious.
If I can remember them.
If you still feel, I'm curious if you feel the same or if your ideas have evolved. So I'll start with the essay from the Image Journal, The Spiritual Frontiers of Film. And we'll start here. All right. So early in the essay, he writes, "My premise is that screenwriting as an art must be evaluated by an aesthetic criterion, the principle of unity of form and content." Unity of form and content. "This principle suggests that an attempt to find contemporary expression of gospel truths, to impart transcendent experiences through film, demands a change in form and structure. Further, the prerequisite for such a quest is to be found not simply in craft and practice, but in the discipline of a spiritual life. There is no formula, nor would we desire one, to begin the search for these new forms, I am convinced that we must first break down the walls between art and faith and integrate the disciplines of writing and prayer. There's a lot to unpack in that one little paragraph. We'll start from the back. The idea of integration of writing and prayer, the spiritual life, into our work, what does that mean to you? And how would you, has that evolved in any way since you wrote this piece?
You asked if I've changed my view a little mm-hmm. of this. I would say to all of that, including that, I feel more strongly about it than when I wrote it.
Right.
Can I explain just a little bit
Please.
Why this is the case? It has to do a little bit with what I said earlier about the change in the modern world and the radical change in Hollywood. You know, the old Hollywood that I grew up in died in 1969. I was at the funeral. there were a lot of changes going in the world, and movies were the art form of the modern world in the last half of the 20th century. Yeah. And if the modern world has come to an end, which many of us believe that it has, however, we can define that later, as a historical period, modern art is over in that sense. Its subjectivity and it had great strengths and creativity, but what it was missing was prayer and grace. Mm-hmm. And I feel that even more strongly now. And the principle of unity of form and content, which goes back to the Greeks and the mm-hmm. Romans, certainly not original with me, is a real challenge for us as Christian writers now, because we're given the content of the revelation of Jesus Christ. I mean, there's no other content like that.
Right.
That changes the whole world. So how do we think we're going to come up with the form that is adequate for that? Mm-hmm. Well, we're not. Well, the most we can do is get pieces of it. And at the heart of it has to be our faith, including prayer, lives. The only way we can meet that challenge is through our lives. The unity of form and content isn't just about our work, it's about our lives. Do our lives fit with that content? Hmm. I think that with the fall of modernity in the last part of the 20th century, we have to find new forms. Now, we would have to find new forms even probably if we weren't Christians, because the old forms that I learned and taught at USC just are not adequate anymore. But as children, as Christians, we're particularly challenged to think in a creative way. I can't give you any formula how we're going to do that.
Of course.
It's going to be the process of living, though. But I don't think it's a matter of our life over here, comfortable, the way we always have done it, the way we're doing it, and our work over here. No, I think the story is going to be them coming together. The discernment now of the nature of art and the nature of grace and faith are now one. Hmm. That wasn't true when I was younger. Christianity, when I was a kid, I wasn't a Christian, but it was just kind of a given. Everyone kind of, even the Ten Commandments were on the school board, you know. So you kind of accepted some kind of vague Christianity as a given. That's not true now. Don't kid yourself, that's not true in the secular world. So we're gonna have to be really creative in a very special way to find adequate forms now. I can go a little bit more into that, but that's
the thing. As writers, I think in what your work has challenged me, and the work of others has challenged me. I think as writers, we can sometimes look one dimensionally. We look at the page, and we look at the story we're trying to tell. Another way to express the idea of unity of form and content, Flannery O'Connor stated it like this: it's not just the story you tell, it's the way you tell the story. And that is something we have to consider. And in the world of film and television, we actually do have two separate ways. We have a way to, the story we're telling and the way to tell the story. They're different things. In a novel and in prose, it's like it's all on that same dimension. It's like in the written word. We take the word because it's really, we're missing a whole opportunity to add layers of depth to our work when we don't consider the way the story is told. Forming, like, it's structure, it's the approach, it's the. So I'm editing this film I directed earlier this year right now, and this editorial process has been as difficult as anything I've ever done, and in part because it's ironic. So this film was sort of forged in fire, sometimes literally, but it's like it was a very sort of compromised shoot. So we had a very, very reduced shooting schedule. Shot this movie in 21 days, and not a lot of days, if you know filmmaking. And we had 14 company moves. It's crazy. But and so I heard somebody say something that sounds counterintuitive to me, but it makes sense when you break it down. They say that someone told me the less time you have to shoot the film, the more time you need to edit it. And that seems counterintuitive because you would think, well, I have less footage to work with, so what else can you do? But what happens is when you have less footage to work with, the fixes aren't just tweaking the scene and trying to find another take or find a different angle or the coverage. The coverage is we have two angles, we have four takes. It's like we don't have much to work with. So the form then comes into play because now it becomes, when the scene's not working, when the story's not moving or not working in the way I shot it and intended it, I have to step back and rethink the function of that scene inside the whole. I have to actually reconceptualize. What I've been doing this whole summer is reconceptualizing the film, the way the story is being told, because the way I did it, the way I wrote it on the page, it's not working when I lay it out that way, the same way. And so you need more time to, like, I took 6 weeks off and just walked away from the movie, which was a gift from my producers to have that time. But it allowed me the space to, like, see the thing in a new way. Because, I'm breaking it up and making it more nonlinear and sort of creating a dreamlike state. And bringing flashbacks into the story to get you inside the main character's head. These things were not in the script as written, but I had to, like, step back and find a new way to tell the story. And so I think as writers, we have to challenge ourselves to look beyond the page and beyond just a simple ABC, beginning, middle, end of our story, and think, actually, how are we going to, what are the opportunities we're not taking to, like, find new expressions of this in the form itself and not just the content. That makes sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So I want to then, let's go, I'm going to read something else to you here, sir, if you don't mind. This is a powerful piece from In a New Light, his book, which is a great book. This is one of the more convicting things I've read as a filmmaker. And it actually has some real-world application in my life. This is from the second chapter called The Second Principle. The true test of our morality as filmmakers lies in the way that we treat our characters. I'm going to read that again. The true test of our morality, that's hard, that's heavy stuff. The true test of our morality as filmmakers lies in the way that we treat our characters. Did we treat the characters that we create as objects to be manipulated for our own purposes, or do we attempt to give them life by allowing them to have a depth of being? As we direct the encounters between characters, are we ourselves open to the possibility of surprise and change? How we imagine these encounters, the way in which we see, hear, and react to one another, is the key test of what we sought in being in the present moment. The other, the capital O other, reveals our capacity to see and hear. Mm-hmm. This actual tenet here, when I was writing my first movie, it's called That Evening Sun, it's about this man who's in a nursing home who decides he doesn't belong there, and he walks out one day and he catches a cab back to his farm in the middle of Tennessee, and he gets to the farm only to discover that his son has sold the farm out from underneath him to this guy that the old man considers white trash, you know, redneck. And so the man moves into a little shack on the property and says, I'm not leaving until I get my farm back. And it sets up this sort of showdown between these two men. neither of them willing to give an inch. And the antagonist in the story, the guy who moves onto the property, a guy named Lonzo Choate, and it's based on a short story by this author named William Gabe. And as I was writing this script, I could never get him beyond a one-dimensional sort of redneck white trash guy. You know, he's not a guy who sits around and has a deep thought life. He's not a guy who considers his place in the world. He doesn't read. He's like, I wanted to be true to the character, and yet I couldn't figure out how to give him depth and make him anything more than just sort of a, you know, a drunk, ignorant, whatever. And one day I was reading the script. This went on for like a year, and I couldn't. And so the script suffered because this character was one-dimensional, and you were just the scales were weighted too hard on the other side of, for our protagonist. And I wanted it to be more equal. And then one day I was reading the script, and I read my introduction of that character, Lonzo. And the old man has come to the house, and Lonzo gets back from town and pulls up in his old pickup. And he steps out of the truck, and the description of was something like, you know, he steps out, you know, his belly flopping over his belt loop, you know, whatever, and blah, 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 and like something and something, something. And then the last line was like, he was a redneck if God ever created one. And I was like, that's a pretty good line right there. And then I realized in reading that line that, like, I'm judging this guy on the page. I'm already judging him before he steps out of the into the show. And so if I'm already judging him, what chance does this guy have to be a fully fleshed out human being? And that was revelatory to me because I had been reading this book around that time, and I was really convicted about the way we treat our characters is the test of our morality as storytellers. And what I was challenged with that is, am I brave enough? Am I brave enough to even the scales? As writers, are we brave enough to flesh out everyone equally? And because none of us are good or all bad, we're all a little bit of gray, right? And to me, but Hollywood or whatever, like more commercially minded endeavors don't always see it that way and rarely do. But are we willing to create more fully fleshed out characters, even the scales? And so that challenged me to go back and rewrite that character. And when I did, I took that description away, it opened the whole thing up. Mm. And one of the great honors of my life was when someone sees that film and says to me, they saw some of themselves in that. He's a bad guy. He beats his family, like, he kills a dog, spoiler alert. And, like, but people see themselves in him because he's just a guy struggling to make it and figure out his place in the world. And so that's a real world application of that concept to me. But can you talk a little bit about that, the idea of treating our characters?
Sure, this is a big one. A big part of the challenge and the opportunity, because if we can do it, we become part of Christ's revelation. It's not us. If we have the courage and the ability to do that, we're revealing the Christ of love, you know, really. The French Christian writer, wonderful writer, Madeleine de Prel, said, Christian love is the love of one sinner for another. So I think the premise is the fall. That's the one thing that is really missing out of some of the best modern writing, including films, is they don't recognize the reality of the fallen condition. We're given that insight as a gift. That's part of our tradition. And I think if we understand that we are all in that fallen condition, that's the essential first stop. Otherwise, you're going to start scapegoating again. You're going to start looking for this guy's background, whatever it was, you know, for some excuse for his behavior and things like that. I think what makes films memorable isn't always just, I think this is applicable, isn't always just the story or character development, but the moments they create. I don't know if you're familiar with the great Jewish sage Martin Buber. His book is I and Thou. And I think the best of movies, the movies that last, have I and Thou moments. They're not that, It isn't just a matter of an intense look in matching close-ups or something mm-hmm. like. It's something that happens in the human eye in connecting and seeing, not the I it, but the I thou. That's where character is really revealed. It isn't so much an exposition. It's right. those moments, I think. And again, that's the grace of God if you can find them. And you know, this is why it's a collaborative art. You can write it, but then you've got to either direct it or someone will, and someone's got to act it, and mm-hmm. someone's got to edit, and then one's going to put some music to it. You know, so it's a communal process to find that moment mm-hmm. in the film. Does that...
Yeah, yeah. You talk about Buber in that chapter too, and about how we treat our characters, and because it's really about the respecting the mystery,
yes,
of the other, the unknowability, mm-hmm. Of the other, which then should transfer to humility, create humility in us.
The on a more practical screenwriting level, yeah. the kind of thing that I used to teach. You obviously want to ask, what does your character want? Just as an actor says, well, what do I really want out of this? But you've got to first ask yourself, what do you want? What do you really want out of this story? Are you just selling it? Are you just demonstrating your talent? There's got to be some deeper need in yourself mm-hmm. that you're meeting. And then when you ask the characters, what do they really want? That's where the mystery comes in. That's where the surprise is, and you find all of a sudden you didn't really know what they wanted. They tell you in the yeah. process, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. That's great. I'm going to read one more thing, if you will entertain me here. All right, this is another piece from the Spiritual Frontiers. This is about, so in part of this essay, he sort of speculates, you speculate on sort of what future film will look like and how, what it must look like if we are to evolve the form in a spiritual condition, I suppose. The films I anticipate, rather than depending primarily on sentiment and emotion, would aim to induce a state of spiritual attention in the viewer, a detached and reflective state. The formal elements would most likely include prototypes, rhythm, and repetition, as well as a new relationship between word and image. The screenplays, premised on the primacy of the spiritual, would be stories of mystery, in the sense that mysteries are not finished events. In our art, ultimate mystery resides not in plot twists, but in the human face. This means discovering the mysteries in the ordinary and implies a way of life that takes the writer out of the studio and into an engagement in a world beyond career advancement. If the central characters reflect the times, they will undoubtedly be people conducting a search, people who are finally unwilling, even incapable of living with illusion. The film of the future will be part of this search, but not its ultimate conclusion. Such an ambition would be a sign of pride. I once heard a perceptive Christian novelist caution his colleagues at an arts conference that, and this is a quote I say all the time, it's more profound than I've ever encountered. The problem with many Christian writers is that they often have the answer before they have lived the question. And that has convicted me and educated me, because that is our impulse as people who have had a revelation in our lives. We want to share that. But we all know that I can talk to you till you're blue in the face about why Jesus is God and why you need him. But until you have an encounter with him yourself, then my words don't mean a whole bunch to you. The truth only matters when we experience for ourselves, really. But you want to expound on that?
You want to talk about the future of the film a little bit?
Sure, I'd love to.
Let me back
please.
Up a little bit, yeah. because I don't want to be presumptuous about this. In the first place, I think we as Christians and as Americans are in a very unusual historical situation. In 1981, the wonderful Christian novelist Walker Percy said we had entered the no-name New Age. Hmm. The no-name New Age. It has no name. We're still in it. It has no name because it has no clear direction. Mm-hmm. It does not have shared principles. We have them as Christians. We try to hold them together, but not the whole society any longer. So we don't know where we're at. Mm-hmm. Let's be brave enough to know we're not sure. I certainly don't have any formula for the future of anything, much less cinema. But I think we have to recognize in reality, we're here in Hollywood and you're writers and you're gonna have to make some choices. And I think this is oversimplification, but permit me. I think there are three basic orientations, and I think we have to respect all of them. In the first place, if you're going to try to make a living and have a family, you're going to have to work within the business. That means you're going to have to work within the framework of the guilds and the unions and the studios and getting distributors and whatever you're going through. Right. Now, that's a very, very it's always been a very difficult thing to do. It means, however, for most of you, if you're going to work in what's left of the studio system, you're going to have to accept their forms to some extent. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that's changing. Sure. You know, this is really great. He's Christmas present. I'm the ghost of Christmas past. So, you know things that I sure don't know, you know. But in my day, if you turned in a really good script, you just prayed that nobody ruined it in rewrite, sure, or the director didn't screw it up. But you're going to have to accept really limitations. But you can still do good work. And we see that. There's still good movies that get made. Not often, but they can be made. Okay, the second option, and this I think probably many Christians would feel, we need moral recovery for the film art, our industry, or anything other part of American culture now, it needs to have moral restoration. Hmm. We've got to have a foundation, or otherwise we're just going to be going in circles. How to do that, don't ask me. It'd be something like the moral revivals of the 19th century. Hmm. It may come about through disaster. It may come about through war or something else in which the American people are so woken up that they've got to go back to the deepest parts of their tradition. Mm. But what I want to talk about is the third path, and that's only for certain people under certain circumstances. And I say all three of these paths are legitimate and should be mutually respected. What I call the third path is the desert path, and that is, I believe, not only are we not, as filmmakers, going to have to find new forms for our Christian contact, we're going to have to find new basic relationships. Relationships with each other, and a new relationship with the audience. Now, I don't have any clear idea of how to do that. There probably isn't one. I know something is stirring, though, Scott. Mm-hmm. I so appreciated this invitation this evening. But this, you know, I wrote that book over 10 years ago. This is the fourth occasion this year that people I don't know, Christians, have contacted me to want to talk about spirituality and film. Something is happening.
Yeah.
Something has happened. And what will that look like? Well, I think it's going to be deeply communal. And I have some, I could talk about a couple of films that I made over the years that we experimented in this. It's not going to be Hollywood. It's not going to be producer, director, writer, credits.
Right.
That's the business. That's okay. I was an activist in the Writers Guild for years. I spent years on strike, so I respect those rules. But what we're going to have to try to do, I think, Christians, is form new relationships, much more communal. And I think they're going to be clearly and deeply religious. I don't mean religious in terms of propaganda, or even education, art. I'm talking about art. But the origin of Western art was the Christian tradition, and I think we're going to have to go back to it. Now, what exactly is that going to look like? I don't know. It's not going to look like Hollywood. It's not going to look like Hollywood. It could be. It's going to be very challenging, but it could be very liberating too. If we want to talk a little bit, I can tell you.
I do think, I mean, and I think it's important to, like I said at the beginning, I do feel like, because we can get in these conversations where it does sound like we're saying the only way to sort of make art that has spiritual dimension to it is to go off the grid and do it on your own. And that is a one way, and it is a powerful way, especially if you want to have complete creative control. I also think there are powerful ways to integrate that into more commercial endeavors, and it's tricky and challenging. I've been fortunate to do a little bit of that. I was involved in a show called Rectify. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it's on Netflix if you want to see it. But it's ran for 4 seasons, like 2013, 2016, and more people have come up to me and sort of said how much that show meant to them, because it had one of the main characters in the show was a devout Christian, and her story and her faith journey was part of the show. It was part of the show, and it wasn't the whole show. And that's one reason it was successful, and because it was just an organic part of her character. The story took place in Georgia. Lots of folks in Georgia are Christian, and so I'm from Georgia. So it was a beautiful expression of that. And so it was just part of her life, and it was integral to who she was, but it wasn't the focus of the show, so it was allowed to have an organic place in the show. And the other reason it worked is this, and this is something that I think in terms of collaboration, but here's what's interesting about that show, is that her faith journey, I think, was one of the more authentic journeys I've seen represented in film and television recently. And here's why. There's 5 of us who wrote that show. We were, me, sort of a Protestant, non-denominational Protestant. We had a lapsed Catholic. We had a secular Jew. We had someone who would say a humanist. They call themselves a humanist. And we had a stone-cold atheist. So those were the 5 of us who wrote that show.
The complete menu.
And because that was the 5 of us who loved each other and trusted each other, that's why that Christian character was authentic, because there was checks and balances in place inside of that room. And here's the beautiful thing, is that I would, because initially, because the showrunner, the guy who created the show, a guy named Ray McKinnon, brought me onto the show because he knew I was a person of faith, and he wanted some of that voice because he knew that character was in the show and needed that authenticity. And but then the other writers in there who knew who I was, initially there was a sort of skepticism. So the first episode I wrote was, I had this, so this girl, she's like in, you know, late, in her mid-20s, and she's married, and she has a life group at her house. And they're sitting in the backyard reading Oswald Chambers, drinking red wine. Write this scene, and they talk about it. So I give this scene, I write the script, and this script goes to the other writers, and we all give notes on each other's work. And I go back to the room the next day, and they're like, yeah, one question, what's a life group? And so I go, well, it's like you get together with your friends from church, and you just talk about your life, and you sort of, it's like a time of community building. And they're like, and you drink wine? And I was like, yeah. And so we talked about that, and they're like, that's weird. And so wrote the scene, and then we got notes. I did the next draft of the scene, and that scene felt a little extraneous to me, and it was a little bit too overt for my taste about the Jesus talk. So I took the scene out of the script for the next draft. It wasn't like super necessary. And so I took it out. Pass it back around a week later, come back for notes. Hey, where's the life group scene? I don't know. I thought it was like extraneous. You should put that back in. Well, why? And then she thought about it and she goes, I don't know. I've just never seen that before. And I realized in that moment that there's like a whole world that people don't know. But because I was like, not protecting this thing and going like, Jesus has to be spoken in this, if she's a real Christian. And I was like, that scene doesn't need to be here. Suddenly that liberated them to trust me to go like, well, you don't have an agenda here. We like that. That's pretty cool. It's a new thing. Let's put it in. And that began this relationship where it was like iron sharpening iron, and like we were able to trust each other And none of, and there's nothing got through there that was like propaganda, because it had to be organic and real. And
that's great.
It's just a part of the process, yeah. I think, about...
Well, you know, one of the good things about old Hollywood, my old Hollywood, when I first entered, I was for some years probably the youngest screenwriter in the studio system. I'm talking about the 50s and 60s now. And writers were very generous with each other. They didn't. You had to have an office in those days. They wanted to make sure you had, even in some days, studios, you had to even turn in pages every day. With that, a little different now.
Right. Yeah.
But so in the commissaries, there was always a writer's table, and some of my best days in Hollywood was with those older writers. Some of them very distinguished, and they would freely give you. Comment. They didn't want credit or anything. They wanted to just help other writers. Yeah. That was part of the good side of Hollywood. It wasn't just with writers. Deep collaboration, integrating people from all kinds of different backgrounds. That was the good Hollywood. And you could see it in the films in those times.
Yeah.
Didn't last.
Yeah. Buddy, you want to jump in? It's 8. No rush. Caleb's going to come talk to us a little bit.
Okay.
That was awesome. We can keep going.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Caleb.
I could have listened to another 6 hours of that. But I'm going to ask you a few questions, get the question part of the evening going, and then we're going to open it up to questions from you, for any questions that you guys have.
Yeah.
So let's start with sex and violence.
Fine. Love it.
Where do you think a Christian...
Captain Segway.
Yes. Where do you think a Christian writer's relationship begins with those subjects? And how, if at all, can they be used well, especially considering the Bible's frank discussion of both?
I make a big distinction. Between content and worldview. It's important to make that distinction. If I were to ask you which movie should a Christian write, which is more appropriate for a Christian to write, a movie where the theme of the movie is that evil is real and it's not a thing that man can conquer on his own, or that might makes right when good triumphs over evil, which is the more appropriate? Might probably say, like, evil is a real thing that man cannot conquer on his own, right? So I just wrote that movie. It's called Halloween. It's called Halloween Kills, actually. It's the sequel. And that is ultimately the story of Halloween, is that evil is bigger than us and cannot be killed. And Might Makes Right is, of course, any superhero film, any Marvel film ever. That's what it is. You can say it's good Crocker's evil, but it really is Might Makes Right, because it's the only way it ever happens. And so, you know, sometimes people will ask me, how do you, as a Christian, can you write Halloween Kills? And we can certainly argue about the content and the way in which that story is told, but at the end of the day, that is the story, is that evil is bigger than us, and we try to, what happens in Halloween is they try to kill it over and over and over. And if you saw the one last year, Jamie Lee Curtis, she trains for 40 years, and she's badass muscle woman, and she builds this trap in her house, and she takes the guy, and guess what? Doesn't die. And it becomes a spiritual thing in our sequel. And so for me, that's the worldview. That's the worldview. Then the worldview is evil is real, and then the worldview is Might Makes Right. Those are things you can't deny. And we would always say, I'll take my kids to see Avengers before I'll take them to see Halloween. And I often challenge myself, why am I doing that? And what is ultimately and content is not something to glance over. I'm not saying do whatever, but I'm also saying Christians generally and historically have a tendency to focus much more on content. Does someone say the F word, is there a boob? You know, it's like, that's the thing, versus like, but they'll show any amount of violence to their children PG-13 violence in Hollywood is radical. Have you ever watched Lord of the Rings? I watched it with my kids recently. It's flipping ridiculous. There are beheadings on camera, beheadings, and it's a PG-13 film. It is insane. The Matrix is so violent that I had forgotten in 20 years. I showed my 16-year-old son The Matrix, and it was shocking how violent that film is. But yet, it's how many sermons have you heard preached about The Matrix? It is a brutally and unnecessarily violent film. And so but you can't judge the level of violence. How big is an explosion have to be? You can say boob, no boob. You can say, cuss, no cuss. It's black and white. We love to be able to say it's black and white, and that's easy to identify. Violence is not so easy, and it's very insidious that way. It's tricky business for sure. But ultimately, the worldview to me is ultimately more sinister than the content, as over what it does to us. I'm sorry, I mean to take the mic here. Yeah.
I'm not going to address the question of what children should see.
Right.
If we're making a film for adult audience, our obligation as Christians is terrifyingly simple. We must tell the truth, the whole truth. The problem about sex and violence, particularly in Hollywood, but actually in many other good movies too, is they're simply lies. Mm-hmm. Anybody that has been in a long-term sexual relationship knows that it's not just about the physicality. Right. It's part of the mystery of creation. I think the best film that will ever be made about sex will be made by a Christian. Mm. And violence is the same thing too. It's a lie. A war may be necessary, but it's never good.
Right.
We know that.
Yeah.
We're taught that. Are we prepared to say that, though? So just be as truthful as you can. If it means a nude scene, it means a nude scene.
Right.
We're making this for adult people.
Totally. I agree 100%. And it's because it's something about something deeper and
yeah.
And if nothing else in this, especially coming from the South where it's a little more hardcore ingrained in terms of like what you can or cannot do, I just want people to open their minds a little bit more about what you're engaging in and be open to being touched and more thoughtful in about what you're engaging with and the realities of being adults. And it's not licensed to do it and make it gratuitous, but it's really about not focusing on the external or the surface and getting to the depth.
Great. So while we're on easy topics, I just want to talk a little bit about the relationship between truth and fiction. Both of you have careers that have primarily taken place in fictional worlds, fictional stories, but you've also both worked in documentary. And so what are some of your thoughts on the relationship between truth and fiction? How do they inform each other? Where do they bleed into one another?
Well, if I may begin.
Please.
I'm not going to theorize about it. There's some good things, philosophers, going back to Plato,
yeah.
Aristotle about. Let me just say, in terms of the immediate, or not just immediate, but the future of film. I think this is the difference between truth and fiction. There's a thin line that we may be now wanting to cross. And I'm talking about form now.
Mm-hmm.
James Agee, the great film critic, said in the 1950s, he says, I'm looking forward to the day in which the film will deal directly as a fiction, but directly with reality. Now, I was involved in the production of two films. I was an associate on one. These were documentaries, and then I was the producer of a second. The first was a documentary. I don't have an auteur cred on it. It was the work of my late friend Ken McKenzie. It's considered a classic now. It's 1961, The Exiles. This was a film, a documentary, about one long day and night of Native Americans, or as they were called then, Indians, on Skid Row. It was real people. And we filmed in 35 millimeter, no less, with a dolly. Can you imagine that on Skid Row? We had tons of footage. And then we did voiceover narrative kind of material, but just spontaneous with the principals involved, three men and a woman. We then edited it into a story. It was a real story. It wasn't exactly their story, but it was close enough. Mm-hmm. So this was a merging of reality, of real people. We even had a bar fight. It was a real bar fight. We're lucky that only one of our guys had to go to the emergency hospital. No, seriously, yeah. The film is a beautiful film. I can say this because Kent, it was Kent's film. He was a USC graduate student when he started it. This is a challenge for that's still out there. We weren't the only ones doing this, incidentally. Some of the French were doing it in the 50s and 60s, too. You guys now have, your generation now has equipment that you can take right into the real world. It doesn't have to be a factual-only documentary, though. It can give you the raw material. I worked with Kent on months on editing, creating the story out of life. The second one I'll just very briefly mention, we actually use actors, but we used improvisation about their real life to create a little drama. It was a feature film.
That's cool.
And there was no script. These actors drew from their own life experience with, I have a background in improvisational theater, so I was able to help that along. But here's another merging, where you had real live people using their own personal resources to create actually a totally fictional film. I'll tell you just very quickly, it's a middle-aged woman who's met, she thinks, the guy in her life, finally, and she throws herself her own birthday party so her friends can meet this guy, and he never shows up. That's it. That's the movie, and it didn't get a release, but it showed very successfully in festivals. Now, that's the merging. You talked about reality and truth and fiction. They don't necessarily have to clash in what we're doing.
For me, I think making a documentary sort of liberated me in a way, because when you make a documentary, you're writing it. The editing is the writing of the script, basically. I gathered footage for years and then began to assemble it. And I spent two and a half years editing the film. And because I financed it myself, I was able to take that time and edit it. When I say financed it, I mean, it didn't cost me. I shot it, like, just got lots of favors from friends and just did it. And but because I own the film, I was able to take that time. And it's taught me a lot of that I'm using in this current season when I'm editing this movie. I was just talking about sort of stepping back from it. Like, when you have 2 years to edit a movie, you realize the value of that, because it does give you time for your thoughts to evolve in a real way. I mean, when you have a compressed 16-week edit schedule, as you usually do on an independent film, 16 to 20 weeks, you have to make all these decisions. And stepping away for a couple of months at a time, coming back, looking at the film anew. But also because when you're shooting a documentary, all you have is what you have. You can't go and write a new scene and go shoot that scene. You just, like, have the thing. So you have to reconceptualize it. And that's given me the freedom, I think, as a filmmaker at least, to reconceptualize The Quarry as I'm editing it now and make it more nonlinear and bring in. But that's all sort of stuff that was born, I think, from making this doc and having the time, and that's a real freedom that we don't usually get, and I'm grateful that I had it. But it allowed me to not be so beholden to the script, and to sort of use it as a more of a template, and let go of it and let the film become what it wanted to become.
I'm fascinated by those answers, and I want to unpack them, but I'm going to keep us moving.
All right.
This will be my last question, then it's over to y'all. If there was one thing, like one thing that tonight you could ensure that every Christian writer working in Hollywood understood or remembered, what would it be?
I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat the question. I missed it a little bit.
Sure. If there was just one thing, if you could ensure tonight that there was one thing that every Christian writer in Hollywood knew or remembered, what do you think it should be?
From this evening.
In general, if you could tell them one thing, what do you want to
tell
them?
Oh, yeah.
One thing.
Sure, create community.
Yeah.
Create community. It's the future of the church. It's your generational future. This is no longer the age of modern individualism, whether you're making movies or anything else. Mm-hmm. Now, creating community, you're going to have to figure out what community is. It isn't just an assembly like this. I don't know you. Maybe you've got a community already here. It's a shared way of life, and it isn't just faith. It's economics. It's relationships. There was a book a few years ago called Benedict Option. Were you aware of that?
No.
Rod Layer, Protestant. No, he's actually Eastern Orthodox. He said Christians in general now have to look to Saint Benedict and our ancestors who went out into the desert and created community. Mm. Saint Francis did the same thing.
Yeah.
My conviction is that's where we're at now as Christians, whether we're Catholics or Protestants or Orthodox, that you're going to have to invent your communities now. Now, you may be able to build on some that already exist. I'm a Catholic. We have two or three international communities, and people have learned not only to live, but to work together, to raise their kids together. I know there's a danger in this.
Yeah.
It can become cultish.
Sure.
You know, it can get extreme and things like that. But if you're keeping the focus of how you're serving other people as the center of your community, then that'll be less of a danger. But that would be my one thing, would be create community, think community.
That's awesome. I would say the key for me, anyways, has been to properly calibrate my expectations, to have the long view. Best advice I ever got when I first got out of school, I took the Act One screenwriting program, which is still around. I highly recommend it if you haven't been exposed to it. Took it in 2001. In fact, Act One gifted me the subscription to Image Journal, and the first issue I ever got was this one right here, where I was exposed to Ron's work. And what's great about Act One is that the teachers in Act One is a different teacher every day, usually because they're people that are working writers and producers. And so someone will come in and give a talk. I teach there a lot. And the best advice, this couple, Chris and Kathy Riley, writing couple, wonderful people. Early on, because I just moved, so I graduated from college in Georgia. I went to move to New York City. And I was newlywed, moved to New York. I'm coming here. I'm going to write something. It's going to sell. I had no idea. This is 2000. This is the year 2000. So, you know, pretty early internet still. Like, no, like, online communities, really. I didn't understand. I knew that I was a person of faith, but I wanted to tell stories that weren't locked in that box. And I didn't know there was anyone else like me. So Act One was a great discovery. But when I got there, I didn't understand how long it would take to forge a career. I thought it would be a lot simpler than that. A couple years, I should be here. In a couple years, I should be figuring something out. If not, we'll go to the next thing. And Chris and Kathy came in and said, for everyone, at this point, they said, for everyone we know in our lives who's made it, by made it, they simply mean that they make their living as a writer. That was the criteria for making it. They don't have a day job, I guess. For everyone who's made it, to a person, essentially, it took them, on an average, 10 years. So they said, this was 2001, and we were all just brand newbies out of school, you know. They said, sitting here in 2001, if you can sit here and say, in 2011, I'll sell my first script. Or if we can sit here today and say, in 2029, I'll sell my first script. And if that excites you and seems like a short amount of time, then you might be ready for this life. And for me, that was like, oh, kind of the scales fell from my eyes, and I was able to go home and have a conversation with my wife that was like, oh, okay, like I thought this is gonna be something more like that. And we had a discussion, is that what we want for our lives? And I know I have so many friends, I'm sure we all do, and couples who have felt victim to this, to the sort of improperly calibrated expectations, where one of them is not prepared for the long haul. And at some point, 3, 4, 5 years in, they begin going like, I thought we moved from Minnesota to do this, and it's going to be, and now we're like, I uprooted myself, and now I'm out here, and da-da-da, and it's caused strain, and I've seen more divorces happen because of that. And it's simple. And like any relationship or business endeavor and anything in life really is rooted in properly calibrated expectations. It's such a big life goal and skill we have to really
also have a very patient spouse.
Totally, 100%, absolutely. But that's really my advice: is really have the long view, because then it allows you to enjoy the work without the stress of like I have to do this now. Have some other means of. I don't know. It's like. Not a backup plan. I never had a backup plan, but I was willing to go scrape and do the day job that I needed to do. We didn't wait around. We had kids pretty early. We just were like, you know, we were sort of just. But I was willing to do the work to so I wouldn't, but you know, sink my family. But it was like I also we had a shared view and a shared goal, and that allowed us to achieve it. So, and 2011, 10 years, 2011 was the first year that I made my living completely as a screenwriter. So that proved true in the end.
Great. So we are recording audio, so I am going to request if you have a question that you just come around this side, stand here, and I will give you the microphone. But let's ask questions.
Thank you both very much for what you said. I've got a question which comes just in one direction, Ron, I'm afraid. There's nothing personal.
Bloody, of course,
It's because Ron said about an I-thou moment. And I wasn't sure I knew what that was or what you're referring to. So I wonder if you could give me an example of that, which you think really illustrates that particular moment in a movie. The I-thou moment.
Yeah, my examples will be historical, I'm
afraid. That's fine. I'm quite historical myself. Yeah.
What Martin Buber was referring to is recognizing the essential mystery of the other person, that mystery of other, and that in film sometimes can happen just between the eyes, things like that. The example of that influenced my young life is that I actually saw Charlie Chaplin's City Lights with Mr. Chaplin present.
Wow.
As a young actor. I don't know if you know that film. It's just, do you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, at the end, that matching close-up where this is a silent film in which the little tramp has helped a woman through circumstances regain her sight, and she sees him for the first time and realizes he's this funny little character, and she says, you? And he says, these are titles, and he says, you can see now. And she says, yes, I can see. It's the look between Chaplin and Virginia, the actress, that I think is an I-thou moment. It isn't just the lines. Jean Renoir has some wonderful little moments like that at the end of Grand Illusion when the two escapees part, if you know that film. There's some films that are not necessarily great films that can have that moment. It's hard to define. You can't prescribe it because it is a mystery. I'll give you one example. That improv film that we did about the woman giving the party. There's a moment. Remember, this is improvisation. These were professional actors, and the actor that was playing the husband of one of her friends was himself a very funny and rather insensitive guy. He played everything for a laugh, and there was a scene improv in which. It looks like their marriage is coming apart. We get a sense of this. And this comic actor stops and just looks for a moment at the actress and simply says, I love you. Now, it wasn't a line. It was what was in his eyes was so real that the actress started to cry. This wasn't just make-believe.
Right.
Something happened in this guy. And then, of course, he went off and goofed off and joked about it.
Like, right.
That's who
he
was. Yeah. But there was something coming out of him that wasn't certainly planned. Are those...
Yeah,
okay.
And in the chapter of the book, and In a New Light, when you talk about I, Thou, and Buber, you use it to talk about... Use I, Thou to talk about how to write dialogue and writing authentic dialogue. And if I can, just read a little bit about it, because using this I-Thou idea, you say, in teaching screenwriting, I found it curious how seldom we examine the nature of human dialogue and how it actually occurs. Mm. From observation, I believe that a good writer knows some, if not most, of this intuitively. I think the good writer knows something like the following. Good dialogue requires listening of a different order. Before anything is written, there is a listening between the lines, hearing the significance of silence, or hearing how a misperception of intent, spoken or not, can lead to new meaning, sometimes created on the spot. Genuine dialogue has no guaranteed results. This is a big part of writing scripts. Think about this. Merely functional language will kill drama as well as relationships. The thou moments in which the other is suddenly truly seen, like you're saying in there, are described by Buber as uncanny or and evoke mystery. This mystery is what gives richness to characterization. And then there's this. Authentic dialogue is prevented by a lack of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Truthful characterization is doomed by a lack of forgiveness. The judgments we impose on our characters, like I was saying with Lonzo. But it can also include the unconscious lack of forgiveness of one's self. Mm-hmm. But the idea that genuine dialogue has no guaranteed results, if you're really living and looking at the other person and seeing the mm-hmm. other person, as writers, we want the scene to go a certain way. We already sketched out the beginning, middle, and the end. And that is going to, 9 times out of 10, force wooden and sort of predictable and stiff dialogue. And can we be risk-like?
Be prepared for surprises.
Yeah, be prepared for surprises.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, next question.
Which may make you have to rethink where the story's going, you know? Like, the more you plan it in advance, you know, I know you got to know where you're going, but, like, be open. Leave yourself something to find. Hey.
So my question is, as a writer and in your writing, how do you guys wrestle with, like, complex theological issues that might, like, frustrate you or anger you or be sort of confusing or whatever? How do you kind of write about those while still kind of respecting God and not, and like giving God the proper respect, if that makes sense?
Well, the beauty that I hold on to is that God is not afraid of my questions. And that's something that I hold fast to when I'm working. Because I think the only way to authentically present spiritual ideas to people is to present both sides as much as you're able to. And again, it goes to that thing about, like, if I just present the one, if the scales are too weighted, then you're not going to care. It's like, because if the truth is the truth, it will win out in the day. I don't have to force it. So I can present a character wrestling with an idea or a thing that they must do. And in this movie I just made is about a guy called The Quarry. It's about a guy who, on the run from his past, from his sins of his past, and encounters, in the middle of West Texas, he encounters this Mexican preacher, traveling preacher, on his way to some border town to take up residence and become the new preacher. And they drive a little bit. The Mexican preacher is an alcoholic. He's drinking the church wine as he go down, and he gets, you know, a little bit of liquid courage, and he realizes this guy's got a bad past, and this guy's on the run from something. And so they pull over this abandoned quarry, and he confronts him, and he's like, "Hey, man, look, I know who you are. I know you've done something. they're going to catch you. You're going to go to jail. That's the way this thing works. At some point, you're going to get caught. But your soul can be free. And that there, and he tries to save this guy out this abandoned quarry, and the guy kills him. This is like the first 10 minutes of the movie. The guy kills him and then realizes he killed this guy whose whole life is inside of this van. And this is like back in the 80s. And so he climbs in this van, drives to this town, and says, hey, I'm the new preacher. And so it's really, it's based on this novel, but it's really this perfect avenue for me to like wrestle with some of these themes, because you got this guy who's like, he ain't like Joe Christian. So it's like, it's really nice because he is the sinner. He's underneath, he's who we all are at some point, just made more extreme. And but he has to wrestle with what it means to speak for in the name of God and to lead. And so we're wrestling with all these ideas. And but it's like really presenting the good and the bad of that. And it's like being able to show the good and the ugly and the beautiful and people who have been hurt by the church and people who have been blessed by the church and who are in this community he goes to and laying it all out there and just being real, because if God is real and if there is truth, then that will win the day. And I can do is like share my experience and lay it out there and talk about it really. And I don't have to feel the pressure of weighting the scales or picking a side, because I you know, so it's not up to me really. So I just lay it out there. Does that make any sense?
The relationship between art and theology is beyond my capacity. I believe as artists, writers, or whatever it is, we should be grounded in our faith, and that includes theology. So we need instruction. But I don't think, in my experience, the role of art is really, except in very few exceptions, is to be explicit about theology. Art tends to stop at the edge of theology. It points in the direction of theology, but it's a different language, I think. And I would be a little, I think Ingmar Bergman and Dreyer and others, you know, there are a few that have gone there, but it's very, very rare. And I think it's risky. The danger is that we are so eager to share the truth that's been liberating for us, we may tend to become propagandists. And we don't want to do that. You'll never convince anybody that way. In fact, a lot of people are rather suspicious of us that we have an agenda anyway.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is maybe a little bit simple, yes or no type of question, but how vital has writing partners or writing rooms been in your guys' writing career, especially maybe early on?
Yeah.
Well, it was essential for me. I was a producer and occasionally director as well, so I had a writing partner who was a novelist, and I wouldn't have had a career without him. If you find someone that is a compatible human being, and we're good friends to this day, he's 90 years old this year, but his skills in creating fresh dialogue, mm-hmm. Were beyond mine, and yet I knew dramatic structure from the theater, so it was, yeah. For me, it was essential, yeah.
It's imperative, you know, it really was foundational for me, because you have to have people who will be brutally honest with you, and and that kind of trust only comes through relationship, and so, because a big part of so this 10-year idea, a big part of that is really understanding your skill level, your talent, you know, and like having self-awareness. It's a big part of it, and so you need people around you who will give you a proper reality check as to where you are on your growth. I do believe, and my experience has been at least, and the experience of my friends, that if you're willing to put in the time, and if you do have the talent, this is a last man standing, last woman standing kind of town. last person standing kind of town. So it really is a, I do believe that if you stick it out and build community, you will get to a point where your work can be read by people who can do something with it. But such a big part of that is understanding where you are on that journey. And so out of the Act One program, for example, I had my first writer's group out of that program. And that's evolved into this point now, 18 years later, I have a core group of writers, friends of mine, who read everything I write. I send to like 4 people that read everything I write. Not every draft of everything, but I'll get through it, and I'm pretty self-aware, so I know where it is on sort of, and then when it's ready, I send it to these 4 people, and they're brutally honest with me, and it's really, really good to be told that you're not very good, and because it's when it's told out of love, and this thing is not very good. It's not a judgment on you, but this thing you've got is half-baked, and it's so necessary. But early on, especially, it's more of an incubator in a sense, because my early writers groups, I really used it. We shared ideas earlier, like, is this a worthy endeavor? Because so many times we start writing scripts that aren't movies. And that's an important distinction to figure out the difference. If you listen to like the Script Notes podcast, which is great, they talk about this a lot. Brian Koppelman has a great podcast about writing. Chris McQuarrie's on it this week, actually. It's great. But like, these guys talk about recently on Script Notes, they're talking about this is an idea. Is it a movie? And it's really important. So much of that early writing group stuff is like, is this idea worth investing 6 months of my life or a year of my life? And knowing and refining those early ideas and starting with a premise and building to an outline and building to a treatment and working it out and going through that process step by step with a writer's group is really important. And then eventually you can figure out those things yourself and then get to the next level. But it's been critical for me.
I have a question. There's a lot of great art out there that's made by just terrible human beings. And so a lot of people don't like to watch films made by horrible, people. And I'm curious, are you able to separate the art from the artist? And then also, do you think we should separate the art from the artist?
Sir, I'm very curious.
Well, yes, we should separate the art from the artist. In the first place, it's presumptuous of us to think we know the artist just because he's a sinner or she's a sinner. You know, it may be, and I have people I knew in Hollywood about this, it may be what has distorted their lives, the evil that they're involved in, has actually given them the insight. Maybe you have to. Maybe you really have to be some kind of a sinner to understand certain kinds of sins. The question is whether the artist is being truthful or not. You can be a very virtuous liar, unintentionally. You know, I would rather be an honest sinner. You know, so yeah, I think you have to do it simply. If nothing else, it's presumptuous that you think you can make that judgment.
That's beautiful. I appreciate that. It's very tempting, especially the last few years and these much more overt sort of public sins. It's very tempting to sort of write someone off and everything they've done. But it really doesn't take more than a couple minutes of thinking about it. If you don't know that we're all just as bad. Some people do terrible things. I do struggle with it. I struggle with it. I would like to understand that and have that point of view. And I do think there's a lot of truth. That's really insightful.
Doesn't mean you necessarily want to have dinner with them.
No, you don't. And I think the struggle comes I think the struggle people have is probably not with just whether that the art that person created. It's like, am I validating who they are and what they've done by paying for this thing, by paying and buying a ticket? That's probably the bigger struggle, I think. Are they going to make money off of me because of this? I think that's probably a moral or ethical thing people struggle with, whether they're able to articulate it or not. But ultimately, beyond that, I think you're right. I mean, it's that it is. You're right. I mean, it's so presumptuous to and to judge someone. But it is something that I struggle with. It's like I love baseball and. I love baseball, and I have a difficulty, I don't think Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. So it's like because who cares if you can hit home runs? It's like, you know, it's not like, what's the ultimate goal? Is it to hit home runs? Is it to be light in the world? Like, so is it, we're validating in something, and maybe this goes into art too. We're saying, well, this is more important than who you are living your life. It's a struggle that I have, and whatever reason it like manifests more in sports for me than because it's.
Wait, we could get into a discussion of the morality of baseball. We could really have a whole other evening, you know.
Yeah. So it's.
Go Dodgers!
No,
yeah.
There's no easy answer. There's no easy answer, and I don't know. It's tough. What do you think, Caleb Monroe?
Ooh. I think something happens in the creative act that creates something other than yourself. And I think this pattern goes all the way back to God. God created something that wasn't God, the universe, us. So I do think that just on a, before I even get to the morally sticky quandaries, just on a personal level, when I create something, it's not me. It's separate from me. It has some sort of ineffable life of its own that I can't account for and that I also can't necessarily ruin. So I do think that, yes, I think there's a separation because I think we are not the same thing as our art.
I think also we're in the context of a celebrity culture too. Mm-hmm. I think we have to make a distinction that probably the artists that we're talking about are also celebrities. And celebrity, there's an inherent, I was in Hollywood my whole life, there's an inherent falseness in that that's worse in some ways being someone who you're not. And I think we may be reacting to that too. We don't want to celebrate somebody who should not be celebrated. Right. But that's a distinction from the work of an artist, I think.
Yeah. And I think just knowing you may be worse than your art. You know,
totally.
Starting there, I think, gives us a place to start asking the right questions, at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. Anyone? Oh, I see a hand. All right.
Hello. Kind of going back to the sex and violence thing, so I work a lot on set as a set PA. Mm-hmm. Do you ever, as writers, think about, oh, this is a collaborative thing, an actor is going to have to do what I wrote on the page, and knowing, like, obviously director, producers have say, but how do you struggle with that knowledge?
Is the implication that the actor or actress is being asked to do something immoral?
Perhaps. Or just knowing that, like, how do you consider, if I may, sort of like, when we write a sex scene, for example, knowing that real people are going to have to simulate this or act it out, is that anything you consider, and to what degree?
Well, I don't think you should ask any human being to do something that is ignoble and degrading to them. I don't care whether it's in a movie or anything else. Now, the problem that I had as a producer wasn't that I ever asked the actors and actresses to do anything really degrading. It was they were treated as objects, even though it was that they were treated impersonally.
Right.
And that was a curse of Hollywood, I think. People, particularly if they were particularly beautiful or handsome people, were treated Even the stars were treated like objects. That bothered me.
Okay.
I don't think I ever asked anybody to do anything really, really degrading, but I didn't like that relationship, and that's why I would go back to my theme of the evening of the key to our work is relationships, and community is based on relationships. And first deal with those relationships, because that's going to affect the truth of your work. It's not separate. So treat everyone that you're working on a movie with as a human being. I tried to do that. I'm sure I failed, but I tried.
Well, not to be reductive, but I think it's very. This is specifically. I am curious because we're talking about that perhaps one day Christians will create the most beautiful and truthful sex scenes ever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if someone has to be naked, we're all adults here. So taking that idea, and this is. I'm curious about this. I just had to direct a love scene recently, and it's not something that I'm super comfortable with. And so then, what's the line between degrading and affirming, or how would you? Is there? I mean, I know there's no black and white line, but is there some distinguishing factor? That would sort of say this more truthful, honest, beautiful sex scene that a Christian might write, and we're all adults here. How do you distinguish, or what's the beauty in it? What's beautiful in asking someone to take their clothes off? And it's not to be reductionist, but it is the reality of the production, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's some cultural differences here.
Yeah.
Say nudity, for instance.
Right.
There are certain societies and culture in which nudity itself would be considered degrading in a public way. So we have to make some distinctions there. I don't really think it's such a theoretical problem. Your heart will tell you.
Right.
If you've got a real relation, is this woman you're asking to undress, is that your wife or your daughter?
Mm-hmm.
Or just your friend? I mean... You know, it's not going to be it's not for me, it's a theological problem. We know what the commandments are, mm-hmm. To me, let your heart mm-hmm. tell you about that. Mm-hmm. That would be my answer to it.
That was my experience, I would say. It was like when we got there, it was like pretty clear what was the right thing to do. And it's really just about honoring the person and looking at them as a human being.
Honoring the person, yeah.
And it's a concert. It's like, what is their level of comfort and what is their expectation? And that's cultural on their part as well. But also what's really necessary ultimately for the story to be told.
For it to be truthful, yeah.
And what's exploitive. And we've wrestled with that in the edit as well. And it's... but respect, I think ultimately, it's like all comes down to respect, and that's top down issue, and that's why you hope the people running the show, the director and the producers, are people that respect other people. And if they don't, it's tough,
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Take a minute, thank our guests.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is
great.
Really enjoyed it.
Great. Yeah. Great.